Hey, everybody. This is the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. I am talking with Richard Epstein. He teaches law at NYU. He's a fellow a long time at the Hoover Institution out in the Stanford area, Stanford campus. And he's also an emeritus professor of law at University of Chicago. He has written widely and wisely about all sorts of government responses to crises. Richard, I want to thank you for coming to us via Skype.
Well, it's something we can do online without having to go outside, so I'm all for it.
Okay, yeah, and that's even before the coronavirus hit, right? You know, why go outside? There's nothing outside.
I'm one of the high risk types, right? It's 70-something, so.
Do you worry? Can I ask you? Do you worry about that at all? I mean, this is a moment of mortality then, right?
Much less than I should, I suppose. But the reason I tend to worry about it is not because I think that the odds are very high, since health varies amongst people who are 70 years old. Mm-hmm. But you have family and friends and institutions and everybody else. And even if you're comfortable with going out and around, they're not comfortable with you going out and around. And so what happens is the constant social pressures to take maximum precautions tends to drive the whole system downward, and it's reinforced by really powerful doomsday scenarios, which essentially say, with respect to the bad news, we've only just begun. This is the tip of the iceberg. It's going to last until August. It's going to claim a million or a half a million lives. I think all of these forecasts are technically wrong, but they influence behavior.
Yeah, let's talk about that. You at a piece that's up at Ricochet, where you also do a bunch of podcasts. Ricochet, the great kind of conservative or conservatarian podcasting and social media community. You have a piece up there where you're very skeptical of the idea, and we're seeing it more and more that, you know, a million Americans, 1.7 million Americans, according to the CDC's worst case scenario, might die from COVID-19 or other kind of excrescences of the coronavirus. Why are they wrong about that?
Well, I mean, it's a question of how it is that you start to model these things from initial data. And usually when you start dealing with very serious kinds of attacks, of which the Spanish flu in 1918 is perhaps the most important, but there were also AIDS attacks in, for example, 1981 and 82. What usually happens is these diseases come on the scene with a bang. They're unexpected. There's a latent period. People are very close together. There's usually a lot of churning that starts to take place. Sometimes they're old people. And so what happens is this virus will start to spread immediately very, very fast. So if you look at the two hotspots that one can refer to, one of them is the cruise ship. Cruise ships have older people on them. Cruise ships are very densely packed. Cruise ships have common eating facilities. Cruise ships have a single ventilation system. It's going to be very likely that if one person gets this virus, it's going to spread very rapidly to everybody else. And the same thing is true with the old age facility that is in Kirkland, Washington. Right. If you have a group of people who are in a nursing facility 80 years or over, and this virus starts to hit, and there's a latent period, it will spread very rapidly. And to this day, at least 25% of the deaths in the United States have occurred in that one facility. Average age of the people who died is something around 80 or 81. Mm-hmm. It's quite clear that if you're a family member who visits somebody there and you give hugs and kisses and so forth, you may have a sufficiently large exposure that, notwithstanding your comparative youth, you too may suffer from that disease. But these conditions are really ripe. Then what happens is, how much do you extrapolate from this? And if you look at the standard models, there was a piece which I thought frighteningly inaccurate by Nick Kristof and a man named Thompson in the New York Times on Saturday. And it had this huge peaking curve, peaking in July, indicating nothing much is going on then. Now, but by then we'd have 10 million cases and maybe a 10% conversion rate. If we're really good about it, we make it a 5% conversion rate. So they're estimating between 500,000 and a million people dead. And there's some people who've taken it even further, and I've heard numbers up to 1.7 million and so forth. Well, you start looking at the real numbers on the ground. The 25 people in the Kirkland facility who were killed constitute about one quarter of the dead people in the United States. If you start looking at the number of new cases and track them fairly accurately, they start to increase, but they don't show any kind of a geometric improvement. Right now, the latest estimate is that we're up to about 900 or 1,000 cases per day. day, which is much lower than it was with respect to the flu epidemic that we had this past year. People start to refer to the Italian situation, which is a bit more rapid. But Italy, for some reason, seemed to have terrible health even before this, because there were more deaths in a smaller country from flu in Italy than there were in the United States by about a 50% margin.
Wow.
So if you're going to see it one place, you'll see it in the other. Then, of course, there's China, and you know, people have been very upset about China, but the total number of deaths there is about 3,500, give or take, and there are a large number of cases that are unresolved, but certainly if you just simply look at the resolved cases, they're probably a ratio, it's under 5% of the people who got the disease were killed. The usual rule in these things is that if a disease starts to go on for a long time and doesn't kill you, it's probably going to be relatively modest, so the percentage of death conversions you'll see in the residual population is probably smaller. Best guess is that the situation in China will end up with about 5,000 people dead, maybe even less than that. You try to take that over to America, and you now assume that all the surprise is out. You're going to start to see major signs of adoptions. Now, what are these going to be? Well, there are many of them, and they take place on different time frames. But the first is these target populations that are highly vulnerable are going to be much more sealed off than they've been before. And that the general population is, by and large, not going to get this either very severely or in very large quantities. If you look, for example, at the Korean situation, they had about 83 people dead, but only two of them were 50 years or younger, and none of them were under 30. And so, you know, this immediately starts to say, wait, that one's gone its course, as has the Chinese one. So what?
Yeah, and you also see something similar happening in Singapore. Now, South Korea and Singapore, Taiwan also gets high marks for testing early, rapidly, and ubiquitously as much as possible. But interestingly, South Korea and Taiwan did not, you know, contrary to China and actually the way Italy has responded, did not go into mass quarantines and lockdowns as quickly. They seem to focus the energy on actual populations that were at risk or had actually been shown to be infected. Is that a better way to deal with this kind of stuff?
I certainly think so, because if you start looking at these ratios, even in the United States, the only people who seem to be dying of this are high-risk populations, very high at 80 and over, high at 70 and over. Even at the highest level, it's about 8%. But what has to remember is these numbers are very gross. So if you're 80 years old and in a nursing home and have other conditions like diabetes and renal difficulties and so forth, you're really at risk for this stuff. But if you're 80 years old and you can still play three sets of tennis, you're probably biologically like somebody who's 55. So as you get older, the basic rule is that the variance in fitness amongst all individuals starts to increase. So it's harder and harder about older populations to make generalizations. That's why the cruise ships and nursing facilities are so powerful, because those are relatively homogeneous populations.
So let me ask you something a little bit off. I both find your, you know, the way you're talking about this, both, you know, kind of plausible, highly plausible, and also very encouraging. I feel the same way about it. And, you know, I'm glad to hear you kind of spell out the logic of this. Why do you think people are so invested in immediately going to the worst case scenario? And we've seen this on certain precincts of the right, but also of the left, and certainly throughout the media. This is, people want, I don't want to say that they want to see 2 million people dead, but they are talking as if it is a fait accompli.
Well, look, I think part of this has to do with the same issue in connection with global warming. I mean, I'm generally a pretty deep skeptic about the fact that the world is going to come to the end. If you start looking at all the short-term indicators, none of them indicate stuff. But the alarmist literature on this stuff is simply enormous, and the immediate data is not carried, is not respected. Well, the same thing seems to be happening here. Everybody starts to think about worst-case hypothesis, and then you figure out how it is you model them. So when the New York Times presented its model with this sharp peak and this sharp decline, you try to figure out what are the assumptions behind it. And essentially what they did is they had themselves a geometric progression with an expansion ratio of 2.3 people getting it for every one person who has it. There's no time interval that's specified in this. And there's no sense that as you go through iteration after iteration, that there's going to be some kind of adaptive responses at all sorts of levels, which will change the numbers. So if you just do this, it's an exercise in geometry and mathematics. Right. It's not an exercise in epidemiology. Let me give you a comparison. reason. When the AIDS thing came out in the 1980s, I was at the time and still am a fellow at the Center for Clinical Medical Ethics at the University of Chicago. And I was working on that. And, you know, I started to understand the way the patterns worked and why it was rapid and then decline. And I got an email from a very distinguished statistician named Bill Kruskal, long deceased, but an important man. And he wrote me the following email. I couldn't have been email, but letter, it was. He said, hey, he said, you know, I've done the calculations on this and humanity will be all extinguished as of the year 2006. So I said, Bill, what are your assumptions? Well, he had a geometric progression. He assumed that every person would affect so many people, that the interval between the next generation would take place. And this starts relatively slowly. And by the time you get to 2005, you got 1 billion people dead. And 2006, you got 2 billion people dead. So I wrote him back and I said, Bill, you're doing math. You're not doing epidemiology. So let me give you the following simple observation, which applies to AIDS, but not, of course, to the COVID virus. He said, if you're a monogamous couple, you're not going to get this stuff unless you get a blood transfusion, which you don't test for. And as the behaviors start to become more fatal, people will start to go away from them. So bathhouses will close down. And even if they don't close down, people aren't going to go to them. So what you have to do is for each iteration, you have to assume two things. One is going to be a longer period between the spread from one person to another. And two, you have to assume that there are going to be fewer people who get it on the opposite end. So those two effects essentially are going to compound with each period. Now, the third feature, which I developed then, and here's another story, is that as you lengthen the period between the first and the second person, there's going to be an evolution in the virus so that it will become more attenuated. So here's the story. I was gave this thing to an interviewee from, I think it was either Time or Newsweek magazine, and they called me back the next day and they said, Professor Epstein, you have to be a doctor or an epidemiologist, aren't you? I said, no, I'm just a plain old law professor. Yeah. Well, I can't use your stuff if it's even if it's true because you don't have the right expertise. So they called me three times. I kept on telling them, I'm just a law professor, has a very deep interest in evolutionary theory and sociobiology, and have studied it in quite detail for 20 years, unrelated and related to my legal work. So when they published the story, they put me out as a biologist or a doctor anyhow. Huh. I mean, they couldn't bear to stand it the other way. Well, what happens is, let's just get the simple point down. As you wait between people, there are two effects that you're going to have to worry about. One I talked about in the paper, the other not. And the first is, the longer you go between contexts, which is going to happen because of all the adaptations we have, the people with severe conditions are going to die off before they spread it. And if it's going to spread, it's going to be spread by people whose virus is less potent, which allows them to live longer. So this means that not only do you have the two factors that I was talking about before, longer gaps and lower contact rates, but you also get yourself a weaker virus. In the early periods, it may not be the very strongest effect, but you're talking about iterations and cycles, which may take place every day or two or three. And suppose you assume a three-day cycle on this thing, and you've got 90 days, you've got 30 iterations, you're going to see an attenuation of the virus. Second thing is, these things tend to mutate very rapidly. Now, what does that mean? Well, when you have a mutation, it could go one or two ways. If it's going to make this stuff more severe, it's not going to pass because people are going to be cautious. If you make it less severe, it's going to enter into the mix. So if you take all of these effects into account, the prediction is that you should see an attenuated virus. And if you look at the stuff that has taken place, for example, in China and Wuhan, this thing was very active until early February. And then all of a sudden, with all these factors working, the thing started to decline. So whereas the front story page story in the newspaper was 150 people dead in Italy, the most important story was that the death rate in China was at that point 12, and the new infection rate was 14. So this means that within 2 months after the beginning, this thing is over, and they're projecting in the United States a peak, which is going to take place 4 months later, that is in July. And then they have it declining, but there's nothing in their function which explains why it declines at all. Right. I mean, the original assumptions is it's just an exploding machine. So once you figure out what the decline is, you have to build that back into the model for the earlier period. This is very bad design work done by professional epidemiologists. It leaves me very, very nervous because they really don't understand the economic incentive structures that applies to viruses just as it applies to human beings.
So let's talk a little bit about some of the adaptive measures that are taken in order to kind of dispel a virus or a pandemic, an infectious disease when it happens. How do you feel about things like closing schools, or closing bars or closing, gyms where it's unlikely that the people who are most at risk for dying from this are going to be congregating. In two ways, I mean, I guess I would like to hear you judge the response that has been put forth by city, state, and federal governments about stopping certain types of activities. Is that effective? And then secondly, from a legal point of view, what goes into the kind of calculation of is this a legal idea or is this a good idea based on limited government principles?
Okay, now let's just do this last thing first and then take the first thing. What happens is there's always been a long tradition of limited police power. And the big exception to the limited police power rule has always been the rules dealing with vismayu or major catastrophes. And so you could go back to the 1820s, you could go back to Roman times, and the moment you get floods, the moment you get earthquakes, the moment you get invasions, essentially the rules of private property are suspended. And the courts have basically decided in all of these cases to stay out of this game. So in one very instructive opinion, the Selective Service cases in the middle of World War I, the judge who decided on this was Mahlon Pitney. He's one of the greatest unknown justices of the Supreme Court and a very consistent and rigorous classical liberal. And so when it came to the question about whether or not the United States could draft everybody in the militias and put them into the army, he just said, we defer to the political branches of government. We have absolutely nothing to do about this stuff. We're not war makers or war finders. So if that's your libertarian judge, you can imagine how everybody else feels. And through all the Second World War, when we had the destruction of facilities in the Far East as the Japanese advance and so forth, the Caltech case, all of these cases were decided in favor of the government.
So wait, I'm sorry. Could you? What was the Caltech case?
It's a case in which the United States decides to blow up a private facility to keep it out of the hands of the Japanese.
Okay.
And they want to claim it's a take. Right? And so wow. The answer is, yeah, well, we did take it. And if we didn't take it, the Japanese would have taken it. And if the Japanese taken it, they would have put it into war against
us. I mean, this is a Caltech building in California.
No, this is in a field assembly in the line of the Japanese advance.
Okay, thank you.
So it's the necessity is only that. We have had situations where you try to commandeer an American facility during wartime at home. The steel seizure cases are the chief one of that. And there's a lot more resistance to doing it. Right. And there's also much more willingness to say, hey, you can buy your way to jet planes. You don't have to confiscate the Lockheed faculty to do it.
Although, and then there's obviously, and we're getting a bit of feel, but there's the Korematsu decision as well, which is a
scandal.
Yeah, absolutely one of the darkest moments in American jurisprudence.
I mean, just you could use fate necessity. In Korematsu, right. The incarceration took place in May of 42. And it was clear by that time, May and early June, that it was over. There was the Battle of the Coral Sea. And shortly thereafter, there was Midway. There was no need to do anything whatsoever of that sort. And Hoover said, and he was the hero in this, I got all the people I wanted on December 8th. I don't need this. And who was responsible for it? Do you remember who the Attorney General of the state of California
I,
was?
I believe it was a man who went on to head the Supreme Court, Earl Warren.
And you get a gold star. And he
I don't want stars in any context of, internment camps or anything.
And then he was so popular, he became governor on both the Democratic and Republican Party tickets in 1946.
So, but to go back to where we are now, what about the, what governs the right of a city, of a mayor or of a city council to declare, they can declare emergency and then say, we're putting a curfew in place, or we're saying bars and restaurants can't serve people in the premises. That's all legal then.
Unfortunately, given American law, the only way you can challenge this would be under a sort of delegation home rule doctrine. Did the state, when it gave cities powers, give them the power to do this? Right. And the answer in most cases is yes. So what happens is when I first wrote about this on the Hoover side a week ago, I despaired of getting anything. But this was before the really heavy stuff came. Now it seems to me that the only thing that you could do is you could battle. This looks to be crazy. What you're doing is you're assuming that everybody is at equal stake. mistakes. You're also assuming, by the way, that there's going to be no serious collateral damage. Mm-hmm. But here's just a kind of a health risk. You start being as crazy about all this stuff as we've become, and somebody gets very, very sick. Are they going to find it as easy to get to the hospital? Are they going to have the right care at home and people are prepared to stay away but not to come in to assist them? What are we going to do about the major financial disruptions? To me, the correct answer in all of these cases is the first thing you do is you give advisory advice. And you look at these numbers and you say, anybody who's ill, you stay home. It's not that you're going to infect somebody else. I mean, that's true. But the thing you have to remember is you're more vulnerable than anybody else to any kind of random infection. And so if there's a very low ambient background quality of these viruses, you're likely to get hurt when somebody else is not. It's going to be largely self-enforcing. And if you certainly have newborns who don't have full immunities, you want to keep them out of trouble and so forth. But generally speaking, if you start to try to look, you can't see it. So in New York State, there are about 10 deaths today. My guess is not a single one of these deaths came from anybody who got a public exposure in a bar or in a school. And what happens is we know, in effect, that the number of people that we have in the state is relatively low. It's, say, 1,000 people. That exhausts the pool of people who could have caused this thing by getting contracted 2 weeks or 3 weeks ago. So then you have to assume that what's going to happen next week, my guess is you'll see a kind of a modest increase going on. But the adaptive responses will be so strong. The thing that is clear is most individuals, when you actually talk to them, are more cautious, I think, about this situation than it warrants. And indeed, one of the things that's kind of depressing about all of this is every private institution that I'm aware of has taken independent steps like the way in the city. So, you know, NYU just announced that it's cleaning out its dormitories of undergraduates, all of whom are age 20 and very healthy. They have to go home. We're not going to have classes. Well, I can understand them saying, okay, Professor Epstein, you're 76 years old. Maybe you ought not to be in school, but suppose I was 30 years younger. I would certainly want them to have the class going on. So I see what happens here is what you do is you assume that everybody's in the highest risk class, and then you overestimate the damage to the highest risk. These institutions are going to suffer huge amounts. And my wife and I, as we even talk to people with whom we do business, you know, the exercise coach, half the people start to cancel on that woman. You know, how is she going to be able to pay the rent? All sorts of things like
this. Is NYU paying you right now? I mean, they've suspended classes. And then are you supposed to come up with some kind of online or distance?
Well, I will do some online Zooming instruction. Actually, I will be doing it back at the University of Chicago, but NYU is on full Zoom mode.
Yeah.
Professors, by the way, I mean, most of what I do is sitting in front of a typewriter or a telephone or in front of a screen like this. So actually, the kind of work that I do is more isolated than most people. What I do miss is companionship with my academic friends and so forth, because you can't go to workshops and conferences.
What are the better or smarter public health measures that you think states, cities, and the federal government should be taking? What I mean, they shouldn't be bossing us around and saying you can't go to the theater anymore. They shouldn't be shutting down things, but they shouldn't be taking over people's businesses. But what should they be doing, do you think, that would have the biggest effect?
The first thing is they should publish accurate information, not hysterical information. And they seem to outcompete one another. And there is, of course, a political science explanation to this, which I find deeply troublesome, and I hope it's wrong, which is that if you're a progressive, you remember what Rahm Emanuel said, never let a good crisis go to waste. And if you start looking at some of the proposals they're putting there, having to do with abortion funding and things like this, you realize that none of this is related to any of the things that we have. So what you do is you always first look for the low-hanging fruit. And so you restrict visiting hours at nursing facilities and old age homes. In hospitals, obviously, you run much more careful wipe down. You develop a contagion ward for people who seem to be subject to the particular situation, and you give very special protections and additional pay, I dare say, to those people on the front lines working with them. In public spaces, what you tell people is, you're going to come into this thing, we're going to basically ask you to clean up that gym equipment every time you use it, and we're going to basically fumigate the place twice a day in one form or another, and then you can see whether people will come back. What will happen is the younger people, knowing that the risk is lower and that the conditions are SEPA will start migrating in. As they turn out to do a little bit better than people had thought, others will start to follow. And slowly, you'll get back to a much more sensible type situation. So what really takes place here is there is a huge preference for all sorts of institutional coercion by government and then even by big private universities, as opposed to information spreading. And if you get the right information that's going to be spread, then all of a sudden people will start to differentiate themselves because they will know whether or not within any given age cohort they're on the high risk or low risk side.
I mean, so like, you know, the operating, the kind of ghost at this banquet is really Typhoid Mary. But what you're saying is that this isn't typhoid, or is it that even typhoid should be treated differently than it is in the public imagination?
Well, all of this stuff, again, depends upon the rapidity by which things start to spread one way or another. And there's no question that early on when this thing is going, you may want at the beginning to sort of slow down certain kinds of interactions. But generally speaking, if you give strong kinds of advices, people will respond to them and you'll start to see a behavior. What's so dangerous here is that people are putting these things into place as if they're capital investments that will stay in effect for 3 to 4 months. And this economy cannot survive these kinds of shutdowns. And you say, okay, what we'll do is we'll just give subsidies to other people. This is too massive to work. You could subsidize an industry from other industries if only one is failing. But if everybody's undergoing the same kind of convulsion, you can't do it. So cross subsidies around. Well, you could say, well, we'll just raise what? Taxes? Well, people are really going to be thrilled about paying higher taxes right. When they have lower income.
But now we're talking about cutting taxes, right?
Yeah, you've got to cut them.
And does that work?
Not enough. I mean, you know, remember, half the population pays very little by way of taxes anyhow. And the rich people, probably they got a string of losses coming out of this recent stock market debacle. No, I don't think it works. I don't think the Fed changing the interest rates will have the slightest thing to do with this. A quarter of a point one way or another will influence long-term investing at the margin. But the other margins are so much more important that no airline's going to start to say, well, now we'll resume more flights because we could get gas for 15 cents cheaper a gallon than we've got it before.
So what if any, would you say, and again, you know, and I want to be clear that you are libertarian-ish, absolutely, but you're certainly not a hardcore, anarchist or anarcho-capitalist or anything like that. What do you think is kind of philosophically, what is the government's role in stabilizing or keeping the economy afloat here? And then what can it actually do to affect that kind of outcome? Because those are two very different questions.
Yeah, I mean, the first thing is they have to rethink some of the prohibitions that they put into place on bars and restaurants, for example. You know, people will be aware of them whether you keep these things or not. But what will happen is the restaurants will start to try to advertise, our tables are further apart than they used to be. We're going to give you a reduction. That is, the firms will make intelligent responses, and then people can start to deal with it. When the government starts to take over, it's just everything is kaboom. It's all or it's nothing, and now it's nothing. And then no kinds of intermediate adaptive responses that can take place. So the government's first job is not to lie, not to put out these kinds of studies, which I think wildly overstate the particular risks in question. And, well, people are going to say, but these are professional epidemiologists. You know, I don't care who's a professional or not. You don't win an argument by showing you got a PhD. You win an argument by entering into a public debate with people who disagree with you. And what's clearly happened in this is there's no delay. It's just generally, largely a monologue. So I'm sitting at home saying to myself, why is it that I feel compelled to write about this particular subject? And it's because I think, A, the models are wrong. B, I've had some familiarity with working with these models, going back 40 years to AIDS and even before that on evolutionary theory. And that somebody just has to say, look, there are two sides to this particular discussion. And, you know, as you start to see massive slowdowns in California and understand that there are 10 deaths in the state from this stuff, four of which happened 3 weeks ago, you know, six people is not there. You compare it to the flu. Right? The numbers are so mind-boggling different. And if this were the appropriate thing, then you'd have to shut down the United States 6 months every year because of the flu epidemic, which kills roughly 50,000 people.
So information is the first step. What else should the government be doing to kind of help the economy or maintain a decent status quo during the coronavirus epidemic.
Well, what it ought to do is not shut things down at the same level that they've been doing it. There's no way that you can shut this down and give subsidies. There are only three ways you can give subsidies. You have to raise taxes. Not going to happen. You have to borrow money, which is
then already happening.
Already happening, but it won't do any good because the interest load is going to be there. Or you could print more money, at which point the money will be worth less because the usual problems about inflation and dilution of the currency will start to take place. So you can't do this on the financial side. The only side that works is to change the productive side of the particular equation. And people have to start to think, which of the things that we're about to impose can we do without? And which of the things can we get rid of? And then what you have to do is you have to unpack the danger. You shut down schools because teachers are afraid to teach students, right? Because they think that everything is going to start to spread. Well, you have to give them some probabilistic stuff. And then if the government had to do something else, this is what I would do. I would say, okay, we're going to run this situation. We want everybody to go out there. And what we will do is for anybody who gets the virus, as of in the course of their employment, indeed anyway, what we will do is we will give you $10,000 towards your medical care, no questions asked. And, well, all of a sudden, you know, that's going to be costing you $1 million under the current situation, or $5 million. It's not going to cost you $20 trillion or whatever it is. I mean, friends of mine have suggested that the GDP will go down by 5%. That strikes me as being very optimistic, given the massive dislocations that take place. And unlike the coronavirus, which will get less serious as you go on in time, the financial dislocations, the financial stresses, the bankruptcies, the reworks will get worse as time goes on. If you look at the legal blogs, as I have done, the single hottest topic now is vis maior, which is, or force majeure, depending whether you like French or you like Latin. It's big force is what it means. And the question is, to what extent, when you have big forces, do you excuse people from the performance of their contractual obligations?
Right. And so this is saying that landlords can evict, contractors don't necessarily have to follow through, et cetera. I mean, like, this is where you can default on, you know,
we don't
throughout
even
the economy.
Know what it means. It just means what the simplest case is that you owe a debt, and now there's a vis maior, you have to pay it. Or you're doing a construction contract, you have to continue. Well, suppose you don't have to continue. You still have to figure out, do you get paid for the work that you've done to date? Are you entitled to your profits? Can the other guy throw you off the plant and simply say that you're in breach? When you start to say that a contract is not going to be enforceable, it doesn't tell you what is going to be done when that non-enforceability takes place. There is a kind of a standard rule about all systems of law. If it's just a question of what's the right and wrong, everybody understands these rules. You don't beat somebody up. You don't basically cheat on a contract. But it turns out if something goes wrong and then something else goes wrong and you have to sequence the wrongs and figure out the remedies, that's when 90% of the action that lawyers do takes place. And all of these contracts are underpowered with respect to this. So to give you what will is one illustration, you have the close down of all these sports arenas. Now, the collective bargaining agreement between the union and the league sort of has a vis maior clause that the players themselves probably don't get paid during this, right? But if you called it correctly or incorrectly, maybe it changes. But what about all the people who work on contracts in the stands, the fruit vendors and so forth? Are they on daily contracts so they could be let off? Or the players going to try to put something together in order to help these people? You just keep multiplying these sorts of arrangements and so forth. Some contracts are spot, that is it, for one shot only. Some are long term. You will be very preoccupied. And what you will discover is that the legal system, when it deals with messy remedies, only survives because of the infrequency of these cases. When you start piling on 100,000 or a million of these things on the same day, each with its own variation, and you start looking about such principles as reasonably preventable and reasonably foreseeable, that's not going to give you the crystalline answer that you want to solve these things en masse.
Final question. How do you feel about the next few months? I mean, not only is this happening, and it is a major, major deal going on right now, but we've got an election that is quite fraught coming up in a few months. Are you confident that we'll have our shit together, you know, say by the end of the summer, or will we be muddling through and kind of doing worse than ever? What's your sense of the next 6 months?
Well, if I'm correct about the path of the virus, this means that you would expect this thing to be a serious issue for 3 weeks or for a month, the way it was in China, the way it, I think, will turn out to be in Italy, or the way it was in Korea. And so by May 1st or so, you would want to see things more or less return to normal, at which point you got 6 months before the election. Mm-hmm. But I gather Ohio canceled its primary this morning.
Or tried to. Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting legal battle, right?
Can they do it? Yes, yeah. That's right. Yeah. I mean, I think in the end, most people believe that this will help Biden, which I regard as a terrible mistake. The man is hapless as far as I can see. I don't think he's got all his cognitive capabilities. And when he had them, he wasn't very smart anyhow. Trump is obviously somebody whose cautious instincts are slightly libertarian, but his public execution of his duties, slightly libertarian. Downplaying it more than the others.
Yeah.
But, you know, he also believes that if you could pull a political lever with transfer payments in one form or another, he'd be willing to do it.
Yeah.
So my guess is, you know, he's a C or C plus on this, and Biden is a C minus or a D plus on this. You know, I count the differences, but I don't look forward to this with any deep optimism. Hmm. And then what I'm, of course, afraid about is that people are going to treat this as an argument for saying, aha, the progressives were always right. We have to redo things. So Bernie Sanders, who knows nothing about anything as far as I can tell, including healthcare, now starts to say the reason we have such trouble with the virus is that we don't have a public assistance program. If you actually look at Italy, the converse seems to be true. All of these public programs, they have insufficient funding for their activities. So what happens is they ration by queuing, have insufficient equipment, they put people on long waits, and that may work sort of with elective surgery. It's not going to work with these kinds of viruses. So in fact, the socialist systems are much less able to deal with this than the private ones, because I mean, the American institutions, when it comes to, you know, the operational aspects inside a hospital and so forth, these guys are very good at doing that kind of stuff. They may be doing the wrong things large socially, but privately, I'd much rather have 100 different institutions figuring out adaptive responses and cooperating than having the CDC deal this. I read a paper this morning about the CDC, and I think this was true, is, you know, this has become a progressive institution under Mr. Obama. So how do we care the ills of the world? Well, we start having affirmative action programs of some kind or another to root out racism and disease control. I took a position, actually, when I wrote about this in about 2004 in the Brooklyn Law Review. The only thing you're caring about with public health is epidemiology and communicable diseases. You're not worried about obesity. You're not worried about lifestyles and so forth. It's the externalities that make it. Now, at that time, I wasn't concerned about the abuse of this public power, which is here now. But it seems to me that once you focus on what you should do, you get a lot of extraneous stuff off the table, which is good. And then you have to think much harder about what's on the table. And as far as I can tell, this constant repetition, I'll just end on this note, that the exponential expansion, the geometrical progression will apply until the whole thing's collapsed, doesn't fit with anything that I know about the way in which these kinds of epidemics or disease cycles happen to work.
Well, we're going to leave it there. Thank you, Richard Epstein of NYU Law School, of University of Chicago Law, as well as the Hoover Institution. This has been The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to us at Spotify, at SoundCloud, at Stitcher, at Google, at Apple, at reason.com/podcasts. Again, thanks for listening, and be good.
Thank you.